I have heard that hysterical women say they are sick of the palette and fiddle bow, of poets that are always gay. For everybody knows, or else should know, that if nothing drastic is done, aeroplane and zeppelin will come out. Pitch, like King Billy, bomb balls in, until the town lie beaten flat. All perform their tragic play. There struts Hamlet, there is Lear. That's Ophelia, that Cordelia. Yet they, should the last scene be there, the great stage curtain about to drop, if worthy their prominent part to play, do not break up their lines to weep. They know that Hamlet and Lear are gay. Gaiety transforming all that dread. All men have aimed at, found, and lost. Blackout. Heaven blazing into the head. Tragedy wrought to its uttermost, though Hamlet rambles and Lear rages, and all the drop scenes drop at once upon 100,000 stages. It cannot grow by an inch or an ounce. On their own feet they came, or on shipboard, camelback, horseback, assback, muleback, old civilizations put to the sword. Then they in their wisdom went to rack. No handiwork of Callimachus, who handled marble as if it were bronze, made draperies that seemed to rise when sea wind swept the corner, stands. His long lamp, chimney shaped like the stem of a slender palm, stood but a day. All things fall and are built again, and those that build them again are gay. Two Chinamen, behind them a third, are carved in lapis lazuli. Over them flies a long-legged bird, a symbol of longevity. The third, doubtless a serving man, carries a musical instrument. Every discoloration of the stone, every accidental crack or dent, seems a water course or an avalanche, or lofty slope where it still snows, though doubtless plum or cherry branch sweetens the little halfway house those Chinamen climb towards. And I delight to imagine them seated there. There, on the mountain and the sky, on all the tragic scene they stare. One asks for mournful melodies. Accomplished fingers begin to play. Their eyes, mid many wrinkles, their eyes, their ancient glittering eyes, are gay. Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, allies, scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. Here is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 12th of November, 2013. Nav Briefing 92, Absolute Novelty. The poem that you heard me reading at the beginning of this recording is titled Lapis Lazuli, and it's a poem from the later collections of W.B. Yeats, taken out of his collected works, which I have right here in my hand. To be precise, Lapis Lazuli appeared as the second poem in the book titled New Poems, published in 1938. That was when Yeats was 72 years old, and it was 2 years before his death, or 1 year before his death, in 1939. This exquisite poem, Lapis Lazuli, is one of the most well-known and cited of many of Yeats' poems. Also, there is a conversion of Lapis Lazuli in the second volume of the Yeats Conversions, which is entitled Tantra Outbound. And I believe that I might have read that conversion at some point along the way. I don't know what would have compelled me or inspired me to do such a thing, but who knows? It could be found in some briefing, perhaps. And the title of that conversion was Amber and Jade, yes. Now, I have been living with the poems of W.B. Yeats for half a century. Along with Dylan Thomas, Yeats was the one poet that had the greatest impact upon my adolescence. This was before I discovered Russian poetry in English translation, which had an even deeper impact. But there is no question that my adolescent years, from 14 on, were deeply colored by the mystical sentiments that emanate from the poetry of William Butler Yeats. And, of course, he being a great figure in Irish literature and a participant in the Celtic Revival, along with his close friend Lady Gregory, provided me with some romantic material for my adolescence, and I associated very closely and intimately with that Celtic mystique and saw myself as an Irish mystic poet in my own right. Little did I know that decades later, as I was coming out of the massive turbulence of 2008, having discovered the term of Gaia Awakening, that I would return to Yeats, that I would be flung back into Yeats. And I can tell you that Yeats came back to me at that time. The poems that I read when I was 14 years old and knew by heart came back to me as if they had been engraved in my genetics. And yet as soon as they came back to me in all that rich resonance and ambiguity of the mystical style of Yeats and the lyric style, which is of course completely gone today. No one writes poetry in a lyric style. But as that mystical material in the lyric style of Yeats came back to me, as if it were welling up out of my own body, out of my cellular memory, I had the remarkable experience of these poems immediately converting themselves into other poems, which I call the Yeats conversions. I can assure you that the writing of these poems was an ecstatic experience of pure spontaneity and novelty. There were moments, and I did one of these several moments were in the witness of my Shakti OTM of the moment, who attended the event of receiving the terma, in her presence right here in this room. I remember one evening I took out the Yeats book right here. It's this 400-page volume from the collected works of Yeats, which are in 16 volumes or 14 volumes, and I just flipped it open at random. And then I converted the poem that was there, line by line, and as I wrote each line of the conversion, I did not know how that line would end. The result was perfect conformity in tone and theme to the originals, but converted into a tantric idiom. I would say that Rilke had a similar experience to mine. Of course, I should say I'd had a similar experience to Rilke's, right? When he received the Sonnets to Orpheus. And you can go read about how that happened, and it's absolutely remarkable that he received, again, two books, the first and second installments, as it were, of the Sonnets to Orpheus, came to him in the same way when he was staying at the castle of a princess friend of his from the European nobility at Duino on the Adriatic coast in Italy. Anyway, getting back to the Eighth Conversion, Ambrancede, which is a conversion of lapis lazuli, has a particular and special significance in my mind. You know, I've said that the Yeats conversions are just pretexts for teaching Kala Tantra. I received Kala Tantra at the same time that I received Planetary Tantra. You know that. And in The Terma is a Tray, I explained how the two termas, the two parts of the terma, are integral. But at the time that I received the Kala Tantra in 2008, I was immediately confronted with the near impossibility of ever transmitting it. And over the ensuing months, this fact, this perception, this realization worked upon me. And so consequently, I spun out the Eighth Conversion during the fall and winter of 2008, simply because I had to get it out of my system, and I never knew if I would have an occasion either to practice Kala Tantra or to transmit it. I knew I could practice and transmit Planetary Tantra, and I started to do so at that very moment. But Kala Tantra, that was another story. So what you find encoded in those poems of the Yeats conversions, as well as the commentaries that go with them, is actually instructions in Kala Tantra. And Amber and Jade has a particular highly pertinent value in that respect, because Amber and Jade presents, and the commentary on that poem present, a teaching about release from pretending. So when the poem of William Butler Yeats, Lapis Lazuli, of 1938, released itself in my soul, released itself in my mind, and converted into Amber and Jade in 2008, well, it provided the vehicle for the instruction of Vajrayogini on release from pretending. Now, I read that poem in order to bring back into the syntax of the human language the original meaning of the word gay, which unfortunately has been associated with you know what. Now, it is probably an impossible and implausible task, you know, the unreachable dream of Don Quixote would be to restore the word gay to its original meaning. But I don't care what people use gay for today. This is how I use it. And in addition, I'm going to back up my reclamation of gay with the word gaiety as well. Gaiety. Gaiety now becomes an essential component in the syntax of the GNE and Planetary Tantra. So how do you like them potatoes? Now, the title of this briefing is Absolute Novelty. And it's my pleasure to say what absolute novelty is and to tell you, even before I explain it, that you are deeply implicated in it. You who listen to me, who follow the GNE and practice Planetary Tantra, are deeply implicated in absolute novelty. My proposal to accomplish passage of command is a feat of absolute novelty. Can you get that? And not only is it a feat of absolute novelty, but it is a specific act of absolute novelty to be enacted within the greater frame of the absolute novelty of the GNE, which itself is embedded in the absolute novelty of Planetary Tantra, which itself is an expression and instrument of the absolute novelty of the correction of the Aeon Sophia. So how do you like them tomatoes? And running through all of that nested complexity of beauty and wisdom is the spirit of gaiety. Now, it might be a pleasure for you to hear what I have to say next. Because I didn't know that I was going to say this. Of course, that often happens. But I just happened, in preparation for this talk, to bring up a reference on the internet. I says to meself, mateys, or meself says to me, you better go look up the gay science if you're going to talk about being gay. All right? There are two references in my mind, in the psyche of John Lash. There are two deeply embedded syntactical references to the word gay. One of them is the poem that I just read, and the other is the title of a book by Friedrich Nietzsche called The Gay Science. So I thought I would go investigate that Nietzschean clue. Now I would add, without becoming tedious and boring you with details of my tortured adolescence, that the greatest philosophical impact in my life at the age of 15 or 16 was Dear Old Friedrich Nietzsche. And I wrote about that influence in the introduction to Not in His Image. Now, it's also worth mentioning, and it is a wonderful element in the destiny of the main Turton, that it was in reading Nietzsche at that early age that I first encountered the mysteries. Because, in fact, the first book that I read by Nietzsche was called The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. The Birth of Tragedy by Nietzsche was the first book I read of that tormented and alienated man who was German and who represents, among others, the absolute shining pinnacle of the Germanic and Aryan intelligence, which is so excellent and beautiful, that the enemies of humanity are hell-bent on totally destroying it. I encountered that Aryan intellectual brilliance in Nietzsche. And when I read The Birth of Tragedy, I was baffled and plunged into a terrible quandary and a state of puzzlement by his reference to mysteries. What mysteries? The mysteries. Well, if you know anything about The Birth of Tragedy by Nietzsche, you know that it contains a very powerful argument regarding the polarity or dichotomy of the spirit of Dionysos and the spirit of Apollo. And so Nietzsche talked about the Apollonian mysteries and the Dionysian mysteries. And in this dichotomy, Nietzsche saw a terrific axis of conflict operating in the endopsyche of the human species, and he saw it very, very well. And he saw that, just to crudely paraphrase the argument, he saw that the Dionysian spirit, which was in some ways celebrated and perpetuated in the Dionysian mysteries, whatever they were, encouraged and invited the wild, hedonistic, and animalistic tendencies of the human species. Well, by contrast, the Apollonian mysteries, whatever they were focused on the attempt to formalize and control those demonic and erotic powers. Well, this is, of course, a brilliant paradigm, and it still stands today. So Nietzsche had caught something deeply caught a deep glimpse of something operating. In the human psyche, in the endopsyche of the anthropos, and propagating itself in shock waves throughout the centuries. And I was completely captivated by this book. But I was left in a state of absolute puzzlement regarding the mysteries because I didn't know anything about the mysteries and I didn't know where to begin to investigate them. But eventually, I did find my way like an old hound dog, like an old deputy dog, bloodhound, Turton investigator dog, with a doggy smile. I found myself perusing The Golden Bough by Fraser, and perusing Mercalliardi and Joseph Campbell, and sniffing my way toward those wonderful and radiant truffles of wisdom which I consequently discovered. So does a hound dog with a crooked grin sniff after truffles? Well, if the hound dog is a Turton, then it does. And that is indeed what I did. And I can certainly acknowledge that reading Nietzsche at that tender age was the stimulus that entered my subconscious, if you will, and set me on the quest that ultimately led me into the mysteries. Now, I don't know what Nietzsche himself could have known about the mystery experience, but I can assure you that he must have had a profoundly intuitive and empathic understanding of what it was. You know, he had a friend, his name was Irvin Rode, R-O-D-H-E, who wrote a classical two-volume study of Greek religion called Psyche. Psyche by Irvin Rode is a classic. And Rode and Nietzsche were friends. So I'm sure that by osmosis, Nietzsche drew a certain sense of ancient Greek religion, archaic Greek religion, and the mysteries from his scholarly friend. And I might point out that if you go to footnote number 186 in Nod and His Image, you'll find the following. It says, Dolores LaChapelle cites Nietzsche, Twilight of the Gods, on the conditions for experiencing intensities. Quote, rapture as a state of being explodes the very subjectivity of the subject. This is a line from Dolores LaChapelle's book, Future Primitive, from page 331. Only such rapture yields the intensities by which aeons are contacted. I wrote in that footnote. There is no better argument for going beyond identification than this single line from Nietzsche. End quote of that footnote. In short, that footnote indicates to me that Nietzsche was fully aware of the experience of ego death and the immersion in the ecstatic knowing of the mysteries. How he got to know that, I don't know. But it's evidence of the fact that the experience of the mysteries survives in the genetic or phylogenetic memory of the human species. If you want to put it into the frame of reincarnation, you can say that, okay, well, maybe Nietzsche had been incarnated into the mysteries, and he recalled what it felt like to have the subjectivity of the subject blown and obliterated, which is exactly what happens in the experience of ego death and deep immersion in the greater life of the planetary animal mother. So getting back to my impossible dream of reclaiming the word gay, I refer you to that work of Nietzsche, which is entitled The Gay Science. And I'm delighted today to share with you the shocking discovery that I just made when I pulled up a reference to that on the internet. The first thing that came up totally blew my mind. As often happens, the first entry that came up is a Wikipedia entry on the gay science. I'm going to read you exactly what this says. the gay science in German, Die Fröhliche Wissenschaft, is a book by Friedrich Nietzsche, first published in 1882, and followed by a second edition, which was published after the completion of Thus Spoke Zarathustra and Beyond Good and Evil in 1887. This substantial expansion includes a fifth book and an appendix of songs. It was noted by Nietzsche to be the most personal of all his books and contains the greatest number of poems in any of his published works. So here I am looking at a reproduction of the title page of Die Fröhliche Wissenschaft. And I must say, I do enjoy this word, fröhlicher. I guess it would be fröhlicher, because the O has an umlaut over it.
Fröhlich.
So there's the correct pronunciation. Sounds to my ear like a combination of frolic and licking. Very suggestive of frolicking and licking with some Deutschen Mädchen. Very tasty word. Now it so happens that almost without exception, scholars translate this word as gay. And of course, that would be an application of the word gay that predated its current use, which is almost, well, not almost, universal on the planet to suggest homosexuality, to designate it. But let's go back and look at the previous meaning of this word, and particularly how it was applied in reference to Nietzsche's work, in the entitlement of his own book, and what it may have to tell us about the attitude of getting through the current nightmare of the human condition. The book's title uses a phrase that was well known at the time. Oh, is that so? It was derived from a Provençal expression. Gay saber. G-A-I-S-A-B-E-R. For the technical skill required for poetry writing that had already been used by Ralph Waldo Emerson and E.S. Dallas, and in inverted form by Thomas Carlyle. The book's title was first translated into English as The Joyous Wisdom, but The Gay Science has become the common translation since Walter Kaufmann's version in the 1960s. Footnote by J.L.L. Walter Kaufmann is one of the great surviving humanist philosophers and literary critics of the 20th century, and I have been deeply influenced by all of his works, including his extensive writings on Friedrich Nietzsche, including his exquisite biography of Nietzsche. Now, Kaufmann, back to the Wikipedia entry, Kaufmann cites the shorter Oxford English Dictionary that lists the gay science, Provençal gay saber, equals the art of poetry. Now, in Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, Nietzsche refers to the poems in the appendix of the gay science, saying this, get this, my friends. They were written for the most part in Sicily, and are quite emphatically reminiscent of the Provençal concept of gaia scientia, that unity of singer, knight, and free spirit, which distinguishes the wonderful early culture of the Provençals from all equivocal cultures. The very last poem, above all, To the Mistral, an extravagant dancing song in which, if I may say so, one dances right over morality, is a perfect Provençalism. Now, this Wikipedia article contains another citation from Nietzsche from Beyond Good and Evil, where he observed that love as passion, which is our European speciality, was invented by the Provençal knight poets, those magnificent and inventive human beings of the gay saber, to whom Europe owes so many things and almost owes itself, end quote. This is indeed the truth, and yet it must be observed that it was not merely these knight poets and troubadours acting on their own who invented love in some kind of narcissistic manner as a narcissistic or masturbatory fantasy, but they invented it indeed in close accord with women of the time who acted as their muses and collaborators in that great adventure in love, in that great experiment that proved to be so deeply and enduringly fruitful. And so the word Provençal, referring to all things of Provence in southern France, carries a unique resonance and echoes down through the centuries. This word Provençal is an adjective meaning that which refers to all things of Provence. And Provence in this case means a certain region of southern France which exists to this day, which is also called the Pays Cathar. It is the region around the ancient city of Avignon, and it comprises part or a neighboring part of what a region also called the Languedoc. And it is this area in southern France, along with its counterpart to the west, which is called Aquitaine, which was the matrix and home ground of the fantastic phenomenon of romantic love. This phenomenon of romantic love erupted in Europe in the beginning, in around 1120, that is to say the beginning of the 12th century, and then into the 13th century, when Tristan and Isolde and Wolfram's Parzival were written. I've written extensively about this culture in my book, The Hero, Manhood, and Power. You'll find that references to the Provençal phenomenon, the Provençal explosion of romantic love, are everywhere in that book, as well as on metahistory.org, especially under the category of Alternative History of the Grail. Several chapters of the Alternative History of the Grail are dedicated, in fact, to this phenomenon. It has been called by scholars in the 19th and 20th century amour courtois, or courtly love. However, at the time, it was called fines amour, that is to say, refined love, distilled love, by those who practiced its methods and who investigated and experimented in the realm of carnal and mystical passion. And if you want to get up and running on this phenomenon, if it interests you, there's only one book that you need to read, and that is Eleanor of Aquitaine and the Four Kings by Amy Kelly. So, thus we have Nietzsche's own comment on what is called the gay science. And what I would like to do in the remainder of this briefing is to discuss what are, not to discuss, but to set out for you, to propose to you, and invite you to consider, in a gay and lively manner, what are the elements and qualities and properties of gaiety. And then, as I do that, it is my intention to bring the topic of gaiety around to the title of this briefing, which is Absolute Novelty. Now let's recall that in his definition of Gaia Scientia, Nietzsche refers to three elements: poetry, the knight or warrior persona, and what he calls free spirit. Those three elements are elements in la Gaia Scientia, and they are qualities or properties of gaiety. The first one is, of course, a poetic temperament, a poetic flair for life, and who knows, perhaps even a certain enjoyment of poetry itself. Poetry can take many forms. Second element, which Nietzsche calls the knight, is, of course, the troubadour, knight, or the Arthurian warrior of that epoch of Provençal culture. For us today, that is the Gaian warrior. And the third element, which he calls free spirit, would be the Gnostic element, that is to say, the element of intellectualism enlightened by the heart. So the Gnostics were intellectuals. So I'm an intellectual. I guess that's fairly obvious by now. And I ask you to decide from your own sensibility and your own criteria whether I am an intellectual coming from the heart or not. That is the only thing that matters when you meet an intellectual. That's the question you must ask. So the free spirit to which Nietzsche refers would have been in the time of the troubadours in the 11th and 12th century someone described by the word courtois, C-O-U-R-T-O-I-S. It's the root of the word courtesy. And then courtois, what does courtois mean? Well, scholars who are not inside this phenomenon and who are not themselves creatures of passion and exemplars of the European phenomenon of romantic love in which carnal and mystical elements are mingled, do not understand what courtois means. They thought that courtois means a sort of a contrived politeness, a set of manners, that is to say, artificiality. To be courtois implies some kind of artificial manners. This is anything but the case. As Amy Kelly points out, that in that time and setting, if a woman was called courtois, it meant that she was perky or sassy, or that she had the capacity to respond with an intellectual sharpness and a sensibility. So to be courtois meant to be impetuous. And the women of the courts of Aquitaine and the women who were the muses and lovers of the troubadours were courtois. They were sassy and savvy, and they were not in any respect submissive women or women who subjected themselves to the criteria of patriarchy and who practiced politeness and artificiality in order to go along with the system, you see. A woman who is courtois is sassy. She will challenge the system. So what is the point I'm making here? Those three qualities of intellectual savvy, filled with heart, and the warrior attitude, and the love of the poetic side of life are the first elements we can identify in gaiety, and they are defined by Nietzsche himself. I would add that another factor in gaiety is, of course, hedonism. The voluptuary or pleasure-seeking drive is very high in those who are gay. And as a matter of fact, in French today, the word gay means fun. So if you're hanging out with somebody who speaks French and you're having a good time, they might say to you, they might turn and say to you, ah, c'est gay, which means that's fun. I think it's kind of an outdated or antiquated expression because I've only heard one person ever use it. That is my friend Chantal. And I think it might be the equivalent to a quaint form of expression, as if today you were to say in English, well, that's groovy. You know now how it is. Can you imagine saying that's groovy to a bunch of kids today? They would look at you like you came from the Middle Ages of Provençal culture to speak like that. But anyway, c'est gay means it's fun. So a love of fun, a love of pleasure is an element of gaiety. But there is also a gravitas in gaiety. Now, I don't know if I can prove this to you or evince to you exactly where that quality of gravitas can be found. But I would suggest, for instance, that you might go on YouTube and pull up some songs of J.J. Cale and listen to J.J. Cale sing a couple of songs. And you'll find that in J.J. Cale, who is an extremely cool and laid-back guitarist and singer, that there is gaiety. And yet at the same time, there is a kind of gravitas. It is not a gaiety that is frivolous and overlooks the dark and difficult side of life. Excuse me, not dark. That overlooks the difficult side of life. That overlooks the hard and hurtful things that can happen in life. No, gaiety takes into account the tragic nature of human existence. Nietzsche must have understood this profoundly, because the first book in which he established himself was called The Birth of Tragedy. So Nietzsche had the tragic spirit, but at the same time he balanced it. And in that balance, there is gaiety. So it's not silly, it's not frivolous. Also, I would define gaiety, if I had to pick an exact syntax for it, I would say that it is sober delight. So there is a delighting, joyful quality in gaiety, but it is sober. There is also confidence in gaiety, and even a kind of defiance, but it is not a sneering in your face kind of defiance, you know? It is a defiance that is detached and noble, and that would not even lower itself to the level of that which it defies. You know, Nietzsche made a comment once, I think it was in Beyond Good and Evil. No, it was in his writings on the Will to Power, I think, when he said, you know, people who are always morally outraged are really full of shit. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course. And he said that moral outrage is a sign of someone who is, in some respect, rotted out inside. We are all subject to moral outrage because we live in a time when so many immoral and flagrantly immoral and criminal actions occur in our faces all the time. And so it's very common to hear, oh, that's unbelievable. Oh, that's outrageous. I'm so outraged by this. I'm so outraged by that. I would venture to say that as you come closer to the spirit of gaiety, the tendency to moral outrage will drop away and probably fade out completely. You could be put up against a wall by some SWAT team and executed because you were picking daisies on your lawn. I mean, this is the world that we live in today. And while you're standing there against the wall, bracing for the shots, you could scream out in defiance, you know, fuck you assholes or whatever. The people who would be committing that kind of crime, and there are many of them today, do not even merit that degree of outrage. Rather, they merit the spirit of gaiety. That is to say, standing against the wall in front of the firing squad, chewing bubble gum, and just before you get the hit, you pop a bubble. That's gaiety. It's not worth saying fuck you to anyone anymore, and I don't say this anymore, because I like the word fuck, and I apply it to the carnal act of sex, and to me that is something, while I don't have to say that it's sacred, it's something extremely enjoyable and pleasant. So I'm trying to remove that statement of defiance and outrage from my vocabulary, and I'm tending to say things like frack you or leverage you, things like that. Those are the real obscenities. Fracking, not fucking. Leveraging, hedge fund you. You know, hedge funds are real obscenity. So there has to be a change, or there would be, it doesn't have to be, there would be a profound and yet perhaps subtle change in sensibility with the acquisition of more and more gaiety. It's a quality of levity, of being beyond it all, of laughing at it all, but it is not frivolous. Neither is it outraged. You know, it could be that at the end of the day, no matter what we can do, insofar as dreaming, to pull humanity out of this nightmare, it could be at the end of the day that the most any of us can do is just say, you know, it's just one big sick joke. It has, in so many ways, the mark of a big sick joke. And how do you stand against a big sick joke? Well, you're going to be outraged about it. I don't care to be outraged anymore. And so I'm finding my way toward gaiety. You know, it might be that this concept of gaiety and the fact of being gay in the original sense relates in some way to the unbearable lightness of being. You may have heard that phrase. It's the title of a novel by the writer Milan Kundera, which was made into a film some years back, and there was somewhat of a cult around this film and the book, and somewhat even of a cult around the expression, the unbearable lightness of being. Was that an approach toward gaiety? I don't know, because to be honest, I never really got it. To me, his book and the film was something that I just didn't get. But it could be, making light of something while at the same time recognizing the tremendous gravity of it would be a mark of gaiety, I would say. And that gaiety, if you acquire it, would then be demonstrated in regard both to personal matters and to transpersonal matters, that is to things that concern the world at large and that concern humanity at large. As far as personal matters go, I guess I may have arrived at gaiety already for some time now, because I find myself at this stage in my life, at this late date in my adventures as a loving animal, I find that someone can take me entirely wrongly, or I can be subjected to the great holy trinity of loss, abandonment, and betrayal. And actually, I really take it very lightly. And so in that respect, there is a kind of an immunity in gaiety, an immunity to being hurt in ways that you don't need to be hurt anymore, because there's just no point in being hurt by these things. They happen and you breeze on. So, to come around to the completion of this briefing, let me add the final property or component of gaiety. Now listen to this. This is purely of my invention, and if you like it, fine. If you don't, just let it drop. But I strongly sense that privilege may be contained in the spirit of gaiety. That is to say that those who are truly gay have a sense of privilege. You know, that was certainly true of these people in the Middle Ages. I wrote in the last chapter of Not in His Image about the resurgence of the Anthropos and the spirit of humanity in the Provençal culture. You know, it is said that humanism came with the Renaissance, right? The Renaissance began, like, say, 1400, 1450, late 1300s, 1450. European humanism emerges. And so these humanistic values begin to pop up like mushrooms against the repression and dogmatism and victim-perpetrator machinations of the Catholic Church. And I would submit to you that the fertile manure and the fertile ground that allowed humanistic values and the humanistic way of life to emerge in the Renaissance already existed 2 centuries later in this Provençal culture. It is because actual flesh and blood, men and women, loved each other and dared to explore the phenomenon of love and define the phenomenon of love and celebrate it in the way that they did, that prepared the European mind, as it were, the endopsyche part of the anthropos living in Europe at that time, was prepared to produce humanism. The humanistic values of the Renaissance come out of this phenomenon of love and the cult of romantic love. I am absolutely certain of that. And so those people who established that cult of romantic love were privileged, and they knew they were. They were privileged in many ways. First of all, they were sophisticated in the arts and letters. As I pointed out in The Hero, Manhood and Power, the knight of that time, if he were to be a respected knight, would also be a, quote, man of letters. Armas y letras was in the Spanish code of knighthood. Weapons and literature. Imagine that. So they were privileged in that they were learned, because most of the people, as a result of the repression of the Middle Ages, when the Catholic Church wiped out the literacy that had been established by the teachers of the mystery schools, most of the people were ignorant, and the things that they could read were highly controlled. So the privilege of being literate, the privilege of having a poetic sensibility, of being able to discuss art and literature and poetry and the refined matters of life, including good food and good wine, this is characteristic of the privilege of gaiety. Another aspect of that privilege is to know that you belong, in some sense, to an elite. Now, I know the word elite is very contaminated today, and it is almost used entirely in a negative sense. That's extremely unfortunate, because the Teleste of the ancient mysteries were an elite. They were, however, I would point out, to the best of my knowledge, a benign elite. They were a benevolent elite. What we see today is a malevolent elite, a malignant elite. And the fact that in the large picture of things, that the institutions of society are run and directed by psychopaths who belong to a malignant elite does not necessarily mean that elite is wrong. There have to be elites. Timothy Leary actually used the term hedonic elite. He coined the term hedonic elite when he was talking about this same phenomenon of the troubadours and the culture of Provence and the cult of amour. I would even perhaps propose the term a compassionate elite. Marcus Aurelius was a member of a compassionate elite. He was a Roman emperor born into the upper class society of Rome, and he was an initiate of the mysteries who shared the ethical view of the mysteries. And if you read the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, as I've said before, there is more moral edification in 3 pages of that book than in the entire New Testament or any other piece of religious trash that's been shoved in the face of the human race. So Marcus Aurelius is an example, and so is Plutarch, so is Euripides. These are examples of a pagan elite. But that pagan elite was not perfect, but it had the general quality and property of compassion, and that compassion speaks eloquently and vividly today through many, many lines in the works of Marcus Aurelius. So what I'm proposing is that the sense of gaiety coming to me now is something that I really need to reach. Because it is so heavy what is happening right now. We are the witnesses to such a heavy, massively catastrophic event upon this planet that without levity and gaiety, I don't know if it's going to be possible to get through it, even for me to get through the next 5 months of this GNE. So I am deeply grateful that I've come across this new meme and that I can add to your syntax the idea of gaiety and being gay. And the sense of privilege cannot be separated from this gaiety. No matter what happens, no matter how it plays out, either in your own individual life, the conditions of your own individual life, or in the scale of life in the collective, in the global theater of behavior, no matter how it works out, you are already enjoying the highest privilege of any one on this planet. You are enjoying the highest privilege, and that is the privilege which is twofold: to be intimate with an accessory to the story of the earth itself, and to be implicated in the absolute novelty of this experiment. That's what makes you gay. Those two factors combined. Or if I were to put it the other way around, and bear with me here because I'm groping around to put this into words properly and in some kind of manner that will stick, that will be cogent. So bear with me. But the other way around as well. You need to be gay to hold that privilege. And by holding it, the gaiety engenders itself in your mind. I think that's about the best way that I could sum it up. Right at this moment, anyway. I don't know what the rest of you have been feeling out there. Unfortunately, my transmissions of Planetary Tantra and my briefings of the GNE do not really add up to a back and forth dialogue, do they? And they do not really add up to a conversation, do they? I'm more or less in monologue mode all the time. I do read all of your emails. I am affected by some of them very deeply, I can assure you. It's not that I don't have the time to respond, but more that I don't have the patience, and also that my preoccupations are so immense that it's difficult for me to respond. But I do occasionally, as you know, in a short message here and there. But nothing that comes to me from you is lost on me. You can be sure of that. Don't ever think that, oh, it doesn't matter to John that I experienced this or saw that or had this insight. It matters to me deeply, but unfortunately, my distant and unknown friends who partake in this experiment with me in the spirit of Maitreya, which is the friendship of strangers, unfortunately, it's extremely difficult to make this into a back-and-forth event. So I don't know what some of you are going through right now, but I can tell you that I wouldn't be surprised to hear that you're feeling and registering the same things that I am. I came lurching through the month of October undergoing a rigorous instruction by Vishwamata that was so intense and so deeply ingrained in the momentary and existential circumstances of my life that I couldn't extract it into language and pass it on to you. But I can assure you that I lived through some very intimate and rigorous instruction from Vishwamata regarding the synergy of love and death, and the profundity of human commitments that transcend the people who make them. I can assure you, if you experienced anything like that in the Vishwamata shift, then we were on the same frequency. Then we lurched into the month of November. I have a terrible, terrible sense of foreboding. It is almost unimaginable that there can be so much fear propagated across this planet through the media and even through the alternative media, day in and day out, every hour of every day, every minute of every day. There is nothing but fear and paranoia and terror being broadcast across this planet. It is really devastating. And I have felt that the whole endopsyche of humanity is crashing right now as I speak in this month of November. I would not be surprised if a climactic moment of this crash, perhaps even with the delivery of a massive thunderbolt of disaster, happens on the 22nd of November. This is the 50th anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy by a public assassination, the first snuff film coming from the psychopaths of the New World Order, the Zapruder film of the assassination of JFK. Now, some of you may know, and if you haven't, I strongly suggest that you dedicate this week to watching Evidence of Revision, which is a very long documentary, and The Men Who Killed Kennedy. Just so you will know that the crime of the murder of John F. Kennedy has been definitively solved. And that has been solved by people who have dedicated their entire life to it, without seeking any recompense whatsoever. Why? Because they, like you and I, insofar as they are genuine human animals, cannot live with lies and must live with the truth. Now, I don't know what's going to happen on the 22nd of November in a few days. As you know, I don't predict. There is, however, an apogee surge with the lunar apogee at the head of the twins and Jupiter nearby. Jupiter and the lunar apogee are again in a converge. This marks the last movement of the Jupiter-lunar apogee tango in the 3 years, okay? That culminates also on the 22nd. Perhaps not what you would call a coincidence. Maybe you could call it a synchronicity in the Jungian sense of the term. In any case, it may well be that that event and the memory of that event triggers something. I have a strong feeling that it will. You know, what you see when you go back and study the Kennedy assassination, what stands out to me more than anything else, and I think all researchers would agree on this, is the spectacular scope and extent of the lies that were concocted and contrived around this event, such as the bullet, the undamaged bullet that was found on the gurney in the hospital where he was taken, and so forth and so on. And to sum it all up, the crime of the assassination of John F. Kennedy consists equally in the lies that have been perpetrated about it, as much as in the crime itself, which was a coup d'etat and a takeover of the shadow government and the criminal element in the U.S. government and the military-industrial complex. A takeover of the United States of America happened 50 years ago on that day in full view of the public. That takeover was an horrific deed, and it was traumatically imprinted into the human mind by that trauma, that public execution, a snuff film. But over the course of time, I think it has proven to be the case that the scope of the lies woven around that event is absolutely monumental and has caused as much destruction and damage to the human spirit and to the mentality of the whole world as the event itself, as the murder itself. The cover-up has been as bad as the murder. Likewise, I think I said this before about 9/11. The cover-up of 9/11 was a psyop that actually was an attack on the human mind that was as bad as the physical attacks committed on that day. So here we are 50 years later. What's going to happen is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination going to be the pinprick that bursts the abscess of the insanity and murderous deceit of the human condition that is threatening this experiment? The abscess has to blow. Is it Fukushima that's going to blow? There's a lot of fear-mongering around that subject. Today is the 17th of November, the day that an organization that has proved itself to be deceitful and incompetent is going to attempt to move the fuel rods out of Block 4 at Fukushima, and a lot of people are terrified about that. Is that going to be, is the needle that breaks the abscess and spews pus into the faces of everybody on this planet going to be a fuel rod at Fukushima? I think the best way for me to describe what I've been sensing lately, along with a tremendous feeling of foreboding, I've been sensing that the endopsyche of the human species is cracking, just as the way an individual would crack. There's a moment when an individual would crack, when their psyche would crack, and they would go insane. But since we're already insane, I guess the crack of the endopsyche would be a turn towards sanity. But in order for that culminating moment to come, the total insanity that is accumulated has to crack, and the pus in the abscess has to blow out in such a way that it's on everybody's face, and there is nobody that can ignore it. When John F. Kennedy was shot in the head in Dallas 50 years ago on the 22nd of November, there was nobody in the world who could ignore it, except for those who were out of reach of any kind of media. And I don't think there's anybody out of reach of media on this planet today. I have the feeling that I'm witnessing, you know, like a train wreck in slow motion. Some days I feel like I can hear the screaming and ripping of the metal as this train wreck unfolds in front of my eyes in slow motion. The train wreck is the final wreckage of the endopsyche of the human animal before the conditions of her correction kick in. So that's the moment that we're living in today, if I could characterize it from where I'm sitting. And since it is indeed a rather heavy moment, I think it would be wise to bring some gaiety to the situation. I know that I have to. I have to bring gaiety or I'm not going to be able to pull this off, you know. So this is where it is today, Mimetis. And let me conclude this reading by just reminding you again of something that I must remind myself of constantly. You know, I am uniquely the person who restored the sacred narrative of the mysteries. That is a very great fact. And I am uniquely the person who proposed that correction is now underway and we can monitor it by the Gaia navigation experiment. So you, the crew, are uniquely that group of people upon the planet collaborating with me to monitor her correction. That is a very great fact. This is not a claim. This is not some arrogant bullshit that I'm fabricating. This is not some megalomaniac fantasy of mine. It is just a simple fact. And day by day, I have to take a moment to register what this fact signifies. even the nav, even John Lash himself has to stop and register the experience of being implicated in absolute novelty. The Sofianic vision story is a novelty in the entire range of productions of the human imagination. The moment of correction in that story is a novelty among all mythological narratives you might examine. The immediacy of correction in this historic moment is a novelty unsurpassed in any other historic moment in any other kalpa. And your realization, along with mine, that some human animals can actually monitor and track this correction, is a fantastic and spectacular anomaly of human experience. And it is so vast and so new that it's difficult to grasp it. It evaporates from realization. So I wonder if you might do, from time to time, what I do. Relax, take it easy, lighten up. Settle into the mood and spirit of gaiety. And as you're doing so, allow that concept to condense in your mind. That nothing like the absolute novelty of what we're doing has ever been done before. And enjoy the privilege that comes to you from not only being implicated in it, but in some manner, now to be revealed, to actually be instrumental in its outcome.